Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Voucher Promise, Section 8, and the Fate of an American Neighborhood, by Eva Rosen, read by Exie Sands. Publisher's note, this audiobook refers to figures included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. In this country, growing up in the right neighborhood means you have a good chance of going to college, finding a job, settling down, and getting married. But if you grow up in the wrong neighborhood, you have a vastly lower chance of even living to see your 20th birthday. In Baltimore, which neighborhood you grow up in has everything to do with the color of your skin. For many Americans in cities across the country, this is a simple fact of life. A few years before I started the research for this book, I went to Baltimore for the first time to interview families who had participated in one of the largest social experiments this country has ever seen. In the late 1990s, a program called Moving to Opportunity, or MTO, offered nearly 5,000 families living in public housing in five cities across the country the chance to receive a voucher that could be used to rent a home in the private market. If where you live matters, then what would happen if policymakers offered families who lived in the most disadvantaged neighborhoods the chance to move somewhere with less crime, lower poverty, and better schools? The goal of this experiment was to definitively show whether and how the neighborhood environment shapes the lives of those who live within it. Social scientists followed participating families as they left public housing and watched to see where they moved, what kind of jobs they got, how their health fared, and how their kids did in school. One afternoon, I set out with a list of addresses, my cases on the seat next to me. I was to track down the MTO families who had participated in the housing studies some 10 years earlier and interview them about how things had changed in their lives. For a third time that week, I took a wrong turn down a small street in Park Heights, a neighborhood in the northwest part of the city. And for the third time, I came to the end of the short block where the road was barricaded with a big cement slab. Google Maps did not seem to understand that this road led nowhere. There were a few teenagers hanging out. They probably recognized me by now. One of the kids shook his head at me, smiling. I waved and turned the car around to try to get to the other end of the street. Residents in Park Heights, as in many other neighborhoods to which voucher holders are flocking, face extraordinary poverty and violence. Life expectancy is almost 15 years less than in affluent white areas of the city. One in four households lives under the federal poverty line, compared to only one in six nationwide. Unemployment is rampant. Despite the drastic drop in crime across the country, the crime spike of the 1980s and 1990s has only partially abated in neighborhoods like this one. For the last several years, incidents of police brutality and ensuing unrest from Ferguson to Baltimore have brought America's attention to communities like Park Heights and raised questions about underlying issues of poverty, unequal housing, and patterns of economic and racial apartheid in the U.S. Policymakers hoped that with the ability afforded by the voucher to rent homes in new neighborhoods, poor families would spread out and access better schools, more job opportunities, and safer communities. But in a city of over 600,000 people, with only 636 MTO participants, why was I coming back to the same neighborhood over and over to find families on my case list? Were voucher holders moving disproportionately to this neighborhood? The story of MTO is part of a bigger story of the way we provide housing for poor Americans today. Housing vouchers. In 2011, I moved back to Baltimore to learn about housing vouchers and how they shape the lives of the over 2 million households who receive them. To begin my housing search, I called a number on a Craigslist ad for a one-bedroom in Park Heights. The landlord on the other end of the line asked me skeptically if I was sure I knew where Park Heights was. I convinced him to show me the converted row home later that afternoon. When I showed up, the landlord, an Air Force retiree with a head of thick, silvery hair, took one look at me and simply said, "Sweetheart, this is not a neighborhood for a girl like you." What he meant was white people don't live in Park Heights. A few weeks later, I moved into a big apartment complex a few blocks down. Here, too, I met some friendly resistance. Miss Betty, the friendly African-American property manager for the complex, unnecessarily tried to assure me, "Don't worry, the folks on housing is all on the other side." Soon, I learned that by housing, she meant the Housing Choice Voucher HCV program, also colloquially known as Section 8. This federally funded program subsidizes the rent of many low-income households who rent homes in the private market. Over 17% of the homes occupied by renters in Park Heights were inhabited by voucher holders. But in my complex, these Section 8 renters, as they are anachronistically known, occupied closer to half of the units, all of them located on the other side of the complex. The units on that side were smaller and hadn't been renovated as recently. I spent more than a year in Park Heights, getting to know families and learning about why they moved to this neighborhood, accompanying them on housing searches and spending long hours sitting on front stoops chatting and people watching in the neighborhood. I also got to know landlords who rented homes to families in the neighborhood, and I learned about the history of the neighborhood and the homeowners who had settled there decades ago. Park Heights, like so many neighborhoods across the country, is part of a larger story of years of housing policy that confined Black residents to poor areas of the city. After the Great Depression, federally backed mortgages made it easy for whites to buy homes, but nearly impossible for Blacks to do so. Banks engaged in redlining, identifying predominantly Black neighborhoods where the federal government declined to insure loans, in which they refused to lend or offer mortgages. White neighborhood associations enacted restrictive covenants to keep Blacks out, and city zoning codes reinforced segregation. In the 1960s, neighborhoods like Park Heights opened up to Blacks for the first time, but through a process of predatory inclusion, their access was on more expensive and unequal terms. Real estate agents stoked fears of Black incursion in Park Heights by flipping white-owned homes one at a time, a practice known as blockbusting. As whites fled in the subsequent decade, Park Heights transformed from 95% white and predominantly Jewish to 95% Black. It wasn't just Park Heights, and it wasn't just Baltimore. In 1967, Otto Kerner, then the governor of Illinois, led a commission that looked into the causes of urban unrest in cities like Detroit, Newark, Los Angeles, and Chicago. The Kerner Commission's final report revealed discrimination entrenched in federal housing policies. It pervaded every aspect of the system, ranging from how home loans were granted to where public housing was built. The commission warned of a nation moving toward two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal. As public housing stock aged and inner cities across the country declined, cities like Baltimore were living out this prophecy. In the 1990s, facing levels of concentrated poverty never before seen, blighted high-rise towers were demolished across the country, and along with them began the dismantling of an entire system of publicly owned housing for the poor. Vouchers were used to transfer much of the burden of sheltering the poor to the private market. Out of the 5 million households across the country that receive some form of federal housing assistance, over half now live in privately owned properties. Residents of public housing were vouchered out, that is, they were kicked out of their homes in public housing and offered a ticket to live in their choice of private market housing with a significant subsidy. By making up the difference between what a needy household can afford and the market rent of the unit, the voucher can provide safe, affordable housing for the poor households who receive it. On these first counts, the program has done exceedingly well. Beyond simply housing the poor, a secondary goal of the program has become to create choice for recipients, providing opportunities to move to safer neighborhoods with better schools and more jobs. It was hoped that by relying on the private market, the program could circumvent some of the pitfalls of public housing by allowing families a choice of where to live. But as I learned from the families in Park Heights, vouchers are harder to use than we might have expected. What's more, policymakers were fundamentally wrong in their assumption that choice alone would create widespread neighborhood mobility, let alone uproot existing patterns of segregation and concentrated poverty. I started this research trying to understand the transition from public housing to housing vouchers and to figure out why a program meant to provide choice results in so many voucher holders living in neighborhoods like Park Heights. What I found was that it was no accident that Park Heights is home to so many voucher holders. The history of the neighborhood plays a key role. Residential choice is highly constrained by the rules of the voucher program, limited by the supply and demand forces of the private housing market, and manipulated by landlords. Yet, vouchers remain one of the most powerful tools we have to help low-income households afford to put a roof over their heads. In focusing on the shortcomings of the program, we sometimes miss the basic ways in which it provides shelter, security, stability, and flexibility. While vouchers fall prey to some of the same problems of the housing programs that came before them, they also have distinct advantages, and they have the potential to be more than just part of the problem. They have the potential to be part of the solution. The Voucher Promise. Introduction. A few months before I met Vivian Warner, she got the call she had been waiting for. It had been so long that she'd forgotten to hope for it. After 4 years on the waiting list, Baltimore City Housing Authority, HABC, the agency that oversees subsidized housing in the city, called to tell her that she had won the lottery entered by thousands of Baltimoreans. She would receive a housing voucher and could finally move off her sister's couch and into her own home. A few weeks later, Vivian boarded a bus with the other lucky winners and drove around the city to visit eligible homes. At the last stop, the bus pulled up in front of a low-rise apartment complex. It was not quite what Vivian had imagined, but there was a two-bedroom available, and she would pay just $55 a month out of pocket from her part-time income. Vivian signed the lease that afternoon. The housing voucher Vivian waited years to receive is part of the federal government's most recent effort to house the poor. Since the 1930s, it has employed housing assistance as a key tool in its war on urban blight and poverty. But these attempts have often failed to help all the people they were meant to protect, and at times, they have recreated the very inequality they hope to dismantle. Vivian is among the over 2 million families whose rent is paid for, in large part, by the government. She belongs to a generation of poor urban dwellers who left the high-rise buildings of public housing en masse, enticed by the chance to break off their own piece of the American dream. More than white picket fences, they yearn for a home to call their own, and a yard for their children to play in safely. Housing vouchers, which families can use to pay their rent in an affordable home, offer men and women like Vivian, many of whom were born in public housing, their very first chance to choose where to live. By untethering federal housing aid from the disadvantaged neighborhoods to which it was attached in the past, this system was meant to offer the poor access to a new world, safe streets, good schools, and well-paying jobs. It marked a new housing regime, one built to create opportunity through choice. With vouchers in hand, policymakers promised, millions of poor Americans would be free to move to neighborhoods of their choosing. It was hoped that housing vouchers would be a ticket out of disadvantaged neighborhoods and ultimately even be a tool in dismantling such neighborhoods. But what happened is more complicated. Vivian has lived in Baltimore all her life. Once a bustling metropolis, America's sixth largest city in 1960, Baltimore was a classic Rust Belt urban center built on industrial manufacturing, shipping, and transportation. But Baltimore experienced a dramatic decline beginning in the 1970s. The large steel plant located southeast of the city, Bethlehem Steel's Sparrows Point, began slowing production in the early 70s and was eventually closed in 1997. Many jobs were lost over this period, and with them, 34% of the city's total population and almost 50% of the white population. Baltimore remains a historically black-white city, with a black population share of 64%, a white share of 30%, and a Hispanic or Latino share of just 4%. Today, the city is largely invisible to many Americans, who pass through with merely a glimpse from a passing Amtrak window. If they looked closer, they might see that inequality in Baltimore, like in so many cities across the country, is stark. There is a huge difference between the crumbling and vacant blocks of poor neighborhoods that fan out to the east and west sides of the city, and the serene, grassy lawns of the stately houses in Roland Park. After visiting a number of homes around the city, Vivian moved to a neighborhood in the northwest called Park Heights. Life expectancy for residents of Park Heights is 15 years lower than in the white neighborhood of Roland Park, where people live to the ripe old age of 84. While one quarter of Baltimoreans live under the poverty line, close to a third of residents in Park Heights are poor, and unemployment is rampant. Even though crime has drastically declined across the country, Baltimore is still frequently named in the top 10 most dangerous U.S. cities, and Park Heights one of its more violent neighborhoods. Residents in Park Heights face unimaginable poverty and violence. It is to these types of neighborhoods that voucher holders in Baltimore, and in many cities across the country, are moving. With a ticket to rent in a wide range of Baltimore neighborhoods, why did Vivian end up in this one? Over the past 20 years, changes in American housing policy have transformed the landscape of urban poverty. In cities like Baltimore, much of the high-rise public housing has been dismantled, but the poor families it housed have not disappeared. This creates an important set of puzzles related to housing the poor. When low-income renters are given the opportunity in the form of a voucher to afford a home in a wide range of neighborhoods, where do they end up? And how do these neighborhoods matter for their futures? While vouchers may not be providing the mobility that was hoped for, what advantages do they offer families? How does a housing voucher impact a family's residential experience? What role does the receiving neighborhood play in their lives? To answer these questions, I moved to Park Heights in 2011. I spent more than a year there, getting to know residents and learning about the story of housing vouchers. Residents welcomed me into their homes to eat meals, help with chores, and celebrate holidays. I accompanied families in their daily lives, attended church with them, and saw loved ones buried. I sat for hours on homeowners' porches, where they regaled me with stories of the well-kept, tree-lined streets that greeted them when they first moved in. I went on housing searches with renters, visiting home after home, witnessing inspections and evictions. I also spent time with landlords in the neighborhood, learning about their business practices, watching them do repairs, paint and repaint, unclog toilets, show units to prospective tenants, and deliver eviction notices. Through stories of the renting families, the homeowners, and the landlords I came to know, I document the reality of a new era of housing policy and how it operates within a particular neighborhood context. Policymakers hope this policy might solve poverty by providing neighborhood opportunity in the form of jobs, social networks, education, and safety. Like their forebears, members of this generation of low-income families dream of living in their own homes, making their own choices, and raising children on their own terms. The reality is that no matter the shape of their desires and choices, the bounds of housing assistance shape their futures indelibly. This book is the story of a housing policy, one that shows great potential as a key to addressing the affordable housing crisis, yet also faces critical limitations. In this newest chapter in America's housing history, the ghetto is not defined by walls or imposed with locks or gates. Instead, subsidized renters have been released from the confines of public housing and offered the choice of living in the private rental market. Vouchers offer a powerful tool to keep people from becoming homeless, as well as the flexibility to move when needed. But only a fraction of those who need a voucher get one. And of those who do receive one, many are unable to use it when and where they want to, if they are able to use it at all. There has always been a tension within the voucher program. While its explicit goal is to provide relief from raw poverty by making housing more affordable, policymakers have increasingly embraced a broader agenda of providing families with more choice in where to live. The voucher program has had much success in the first goal, but it has largely failed in the second. Despite lofty hopes of uprooting patterns of racial segregation and poverty, this new approach to housing the poor has instead mirrored those same patterns. While families who receive assistance through a voucher, in theory, have more choice than they would have in public housing, much like their unsubsidized counterparts, they face severe barriers to finding a home of their choice in the private market. In some cases, the stigma of housing assistance makes finding a home even harder. It might seem paradoxical that a federal program that some imagined would be a tool to dismantle concentrated poverty and segregation would end up mirroring the very same patterns, but perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. Given the policy decision to rely, by design, on the private production and management of rental housing to meet the housing needs of very low-income people, perhaps we might have expected that such a program would mirror the patterns of discrimination and segregation in the private market. And without measures to counteract these private market forces, it will continue to do so. A short history of housing inequality. A roof over one's head. A place to call home. These are quintessential markers of the American dream. Housing is inextricably linked to a wide array of social goods like stable employment, quality education, health and well-being, and the accrual of wealth. And just as there is so much good brought by a safe, stable home, the lack of one can inflict much harm. It is impossible to understand inequality in this country without first understanding the ways in which housing and the policies that surround it have made, unmade, and remade patterns of concentrated poverty and racial segregation. Housing lies at the nexus of pervasive poverty, rapidly rising inequality, and pockets of stubbornly entrenched racial segregation. There is a recent return to studying housing itself, not just as a physical entity, but as a structure that shapes social relationships in important ways. In fact, this tradition in sociology goes way back. W.E.B. Du Bois studied housing in Philadelphia's 7th Ward in the Philadelphia Negro, 1899, and Lewis Worth set an agenda for housing as a field of sociological research. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, sociologists such as Lee Rainwater and Herbert Gans studied how the physical setting of the home shaped social relations in the public housing complex of the notorious Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis and in the slum neighborhood of the West End in Boston before they were torn down. Since then, sociologists have shifted to focusing their attention more on the neighborhood context than on the housing itself. William Julius Wilson's The Truly Disadvantaged brought attention to the plight of the urban poor in the inner cities of Rust Belt urban areas like Chicago, where manufacturing jobs had departed, and with them, the middle class. Wilson's attention to this population inspired decades of ethnographic work. Elijah Anderson's Code of the Street, examining the social code of behavior in urban neighborhoods. Mary Petillo's Black Picket Fences, considering the plight of a middle-class black neighborhood. Sudhir Venkatesh's American Project, looking at public housing residents as their homes were being torn down. And more recently, works such as Matthew Desmond's Evicted, looking at the process of eviction among poor tenants in Milwaukee. And Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer's $2 a Day, documenting the survival tactics of the extreme poor. However, more than an ethnography of a place, a community, or a group of people, though it is these things too, this book is an ethnography of a policy. This book attempts to bring the physical nature of housing, the markets that govern it, and the social relationships to which housing structures give rise back into the study of neighborhoods in urban sociology. We are embedded not merely in our neighborhoods, but also in our homes, and the role of landlords, a key actor in the lives of poor Americans, remains largely unexplored. In this way, housing conditions are not just an outcome of poverty, but also a cause. Across the history of this country, the right to a home has never been inalienable, and some Americans have always had more access to it than others. In order to understand the landscape of housing in Park Heights, it is important to understand the history of housing discrimination, which has affected the life chances and well-being of poor minority Americans throughout the history of this country. Even as the federal government has employed housing assistance as a tool in its war on poverty and urban blight, and the legal system has been used to combat entrenched discriminatory housing practices, housing discrimination has remained deeply entrenched in both private and public practice, as well as in the law itself. In the private domain, this country has a deep and ugly tradition of excluding blacks from white neighborhoods. As black families migrated from the South during the Great Migration, many white communities reacted by enacting racially restrictive covenants, which were legally binding agreements among homeowners dictating that their properties could not be passed on to African Americans. These agreements were enforced by homeowner and neighborhood associations. In a 1917 case, Buchanan v. Worley, the Supreme Court declared explicit racial zoning, ordinances barring those of certain racial backgrounds in certain neighborhoods, to be unconstitutional, an important win for civil rights. However, the case only applied to explicit racial zoning, and so economic zoning, enlarging lot sizes and prohibiting multifamily dwellings, became more commonplace. Private racial covenants also became even more widespread in backlash to the ruling. In 1926, the Supreme Court upheld private racial covenants in Corrigan v. Buckley. It wasn't until 1948 in Shelley v. Kramer that the court decided that private covenants were unenforceable in a court of law. And in 1968, the Fair Housing Act made writing racial covenants into home deeds illegal. However, because private agreements are attached to land titles in perpetuity until they are manually removed, they remained widespread, effectively keeping black residents out of white communities across the country for years to come. Simultaneously, blacks were systematically unable to access mortgage capital. The Federal Housing Authority, FHA, created in 1934 to regulate home mortgages and make home ownership more widely available, underwrote home loans for millions of white Americans while systematically denying them to black families. This process, called redlining for the crimson lines drawn around the risky neighborhoods inhabited by African Americans, was a racially based color-coded mapping system that banks used to determine the provision of federally backed home loans. Excluding black neighborhoods from access to the home loans that were extended to large swaths of the rest of the country starved these communities of much-needed mortgage capital. It asphyxiated development, limiting residents' access to adequate civil services, public transportation, and even fresh food. Redlining was curbed by the Fair Housing Act of 1968 and the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, and is no longer supported by federal underwriting of home loans. However, real estate agents, property owners, and loan officers continued to discriminate against black renters and homebuyers. and policies to outlaw and remedy the discriminatory practices of racial covenants and redlining were not sufficient to undo decades of disinvestment, underdevelopment, landlord abandonment, and even arson. The damage was done. In the domain of federally assisted rental housing as well, both de facto and de jure discrimination have shaped opportunities for low-income Americans, especially minority groups. Since its inception in the 1930s, federal housing assistance has offered housing to many who need it, in the hopes that a clean and safe place to live will lift the destitute out of the trenches of poverty. But today, only 1/4 of those in this country who need housing assistance get it. And even for those lucky enough to receive assistance, federal programs have not always worked the way they were meant to. Housing policy in the U.S. has cycled through a series of attempts at dismantling poverty. Tenement housing in neighborhoods like New York's Lower East Side and Chicago's South Side were America's first ghettos. As immigrants came to the cities for work, they were housed in old buildings divided into small apartments that soon were teeming with families and tuberculosis. The federal government's role in housing the poor developed in response. In the 1930s, when modern industry, urbanization, and the ills of the Great Depression brought hardship for the working class to a fever pitch in America's cities, the U.S. government sought to alleviate the misery of slums overflowing with immigrants from overseas and migrants from the South. In the decades of the mid-century, these tenements were replaced with low-rise garden-style public housing. In other areas, state-of-the-art high-rise towers were erected with public funding and great fanfare across the country. These tall towers were gleaming celebrations of modern technology. In a new approach to housing the poor, these buildings promised health, safety, and efficiency. This high-rise housing, typified by buildings such as the Pruitt-Igoe homes in St. Louis and Cabrini Green in Chicago, was intended as a temporary solution for families from all walks of life to keep a roof over their heads when they fell on hard times. For the early residents of public housing, the immediate improvement was dramatic. The hazardous slum dwellings from which they had moved were largely built in the 19th century and lacked basic services like electricity and running water. The new buildings, modeled after European designs, offered hot water and modern amenities such as washing machines, elevators, and large windows with good air circulation. However, the gleam of the unblemished towers did not last long. Less than 20 years after Pruitt-Igoe opened, it was emptied out and demolished. In cities across the country, funding to maintain the buildings was hugely inadequate. The purported state-of-the-art design elements featured in many public housing complexes turned out to be urban nightmares in practice. Breezeways designed to provide airflow and access to the outdoors became wind tunnels in icy northern cities. Common spaces meant to foster community were instead monopolized by gangs. Buildings that faced inward rather than out in order to foster a sense of community instead walled off projects from their surroundings. These problems were compounded in cities like Chicago, where the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, withheld federal funding for maintenance in the face of gross local mismanagement. Buildings harbored long lists of unfinished repairs, creating hazards such as lead paint, cockroach and rodent infestations, and unrepaired elevators, leaving residents to climb the poorly lit stairwells besieged by drug dealers. There were reports of children falling from windows lacking safety guards in high-rise buildings. The real problem was inadequate funding. As financial reserves dried up and maintenance flagged, the towers soon came to be seen as urban eyesores and created what historian Arnold Hirsch called the second ghetto. Families who lived in high-rise public housing, disproportionately African-American, had no choice but to live in the racially segregated and poverty-stricken neighborhoods where it was built. In 1967, broader patterns of racial residential segregation were laid bare in the Kerner Commission's report. The commission was convened by the federal government to try to understand the riots of the 1960s in cities like Detroit, Newark, Los Angeles, and Chicago, and it famously warned of the pernicious effects of inequality. The report implicated federal housing policy as complicit in the creation and maintenance of the ghetto. Families who relied on housing assistance had no choice in where they lived. They likened the concrete walls of many public housing buildings to those of a prison. These two factors, the concentration of poverty and the lack of choice in a place to live, would come to dominate the conversation around housing policy solutions. Scholars of the city have long argued that the geographic unit of the neighborhood and everything that it encompasses housing structures and the built environment, social networks, the spatial distribution of resources such as schools, job opportunities, and transportation have an important influence on life outcomes above and beyond individual characteristics. In his seminal book, The Truly Disadvantaged, William Julius Wilson argued that with the decline in manufacturing and the departure of the black...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?